Hey everybody, before we get into the video, I just wanted to bring some things to your attention and ask for your support. If you're not interested or you're not able to support the channel, I want to make sure that I respect your time, so feel free to skip ahead to this timestamp. For those of you that have stuck around, thank you, and I will get straight to the point. Second thought is in the red. We just finished running last year's numbers, and it's not great. It's not the end of the world, don't freak out just yet, but it's not really the numbers that you want to see. Part of that is that we moved locations and we had to build this little studio shed because office space is way too expensive around here. But even if we remove that expense from the spreadsheet, we're still bleeding about $2,000 per month. The only thing keeping Second Thought afloat right now is the Deprogram, the podcast that I do with Hakeem and Ugopnik. The other part of the problem, leaving aside the fact that YouTube hates left-wing content, is my own fault. Second Thought is a tiny, independent outlet that punches at an institutional level, because that's important to how I see our role as the mouth of the socialist funnel. Our editing, our motion design, our scripts, it's all at the level of outlets like Vox or Vice, companies that have dozens of employees and millions of dollars to spend on their projects. We are a team of four on a shoestring budget that's 90% Patreon and the remaining 10% made up of our one sponsor and the peanuts we get from AdSense. Because of these pesky socialist principles, I feel compelled to make sure that every person on the team is paid fairly for their work, and that includes annual raises that outpace inflation. Maintaining the quality that we're known for and paying everyone's salaries and benefits, as well as doing annual raises, is challenging when we're already bleeding money. So, bottom line, if we can't find a way to get Second Thought back above water, we're going to need to reassess over the next year or so. We're working on some cool projects behind the scenes which will hopefully help, but those also cost money, so, you know, it's a gamble. If you're in a position to help keep this channel afloat, I would greatly appreciate the support. Now, I don't ask for your generosity without offering something in return. We've already got the Discord server, which is a really cool place. It's got a book club, it's got educator roles, all that good stuff, and we do early access and ad-free versions of every video on the Patreon. But if there's something else that would make becoming a patron more enticing, please do let me know in the comments and I'll see what I can do. Or heck, if you work at some socialist outlet that somehow has money, may I present an enticing purchase opportunity? Half joking there, but I do really want this project to continue, and if I'm not able to foot the bill myself, I'll do my best to find a way. Anyway, thank you for sticking around. I just wanted to keep you all in the loop, and if you do choose to support the channel on Patreon, I can't possibly thank you enough. It is only because of viewers like you that this channel exists in the first place. All right, on with the show.
Let's get to some breaking news from the Supreme Court. The justices have ruled 6-3 in favor of South Carolina's move to cut Medicaid funding to Planned Parenthood.
The court sided with a group of religious Maryland parents.
References to transgender and queer people have been removed from the Stonewall National Monument.
The Supreme Court sounded like they're leaning toward knocking down a conversion therapy ban in Colorado.
Amid reports of nearly 1,000 anti-LGBTQ incidents across the country over the past year alone.
LGBT and women's rights are, as you probably know, under attack. I'm sure I didn't need to remind you. We are all painfully aware of how bad things keep getting. This admin is hell-bent on waging a war against trans people, and as time goes on, that war keeps spreading to the rest of the queer community and women.
A decade after the Supreme Court's landmark Obergefell decision extending the right to marriage to same-sex couples across the country, the Supreme Court could soon consider whether to take up a case asking them to overturn it.
It's scary and immensely frustrating. And it turns out, we're not alone in this. All over the world, experts are warning of a global backslide in queer and women's rights. It's not that there's no progress on these issues, but there's a lot more bad than good. Take the UK, for example. Just this year, Keir Starmer from the left-ish Labour Party did a complete U-turn on trans rights, equating gender and sex assigned at birth. That switch is designed to kick trans women out of women's spaces, and it tells transphobes that the government isn't gonna make a fuss if they take enforcing that exclusion into their own hands. And Keir's not alone, either. Around the same time, from the other end of the stunted UK political spectrum, Nigel Farage took a similar reactionary stance, calling it, quote, utterly ridiculous that the UK allows abortion up to 24 weeks, and hinting that the Parliament should do something about it. Now, Farage is a far-right politician. Anti-abortion is a pretty common far-right talking point. You'd be forgiven for not being all that surprised. Except that in 31 years in politics, this is the first time Farage has had any sort of anti-abortion stance. Not only that, the UK isn't a country where abortion is unpopular or divisive like it is here in the US. Only 6% of Brits want to ban it, and nearly 90% are in support. Even the 24 weeks limit has broad support. Which makes all this a bit weird. Especially because it's not the only story like this.
A major battle is underway over abortion rights in Poland.
These last few years we've seen other countries, like Poland and Hungary, roll back their abortion rights too. Hungary also outright banned pride events, and Poland had almost a quarter of the country declaring itself an LGBT-free zone. Last year, Georgia passed a bunch of anti-LGBT laws that equate homosexuality with incest. Uganda, just 2 years ago, made homosexuality punishable by imprisonment and sometimes even death. All these Latin American countries, countries that have been at the forefront of LGBT politics for years, have had massive anti-LGBT protests. And in all these European countries, conservative politicians running for office have recently started calling queer people threats to society. There's a backlash. And like with the Farage abortion stuff, it's tempting to see this as predictable or even normal. We're used to the idea of politics being like a pendulum, swinging between progressive and reactionary as people take time to adjust. Like, sure, these countries are on a backswing now, but you know, give it time and things will head in the right direction again soon. Except that if we dig a little bit, that's not what's going on. In a lot of these cases, the pendulum isn't just swinging back on its own. People aren't just suddenly opposed to something they thought was fine a few years ago. Someone is pushing to turn back the clock. Someone from the outside. Someone in the US. Right before Farage started talking about abortion all of a sudden, he met with several such someones. Representatives from an American group called the Alliance Defending Freedom. If you haven't heard about them, the ADF is a group that bills itself as the world's largest legal organization fighting for, quote, every person's God-given right to live and speak the truth. We'll get to the second part of that sentence in a sec, but they're probably right about that first bit. The ADF may legitimately be the largest Christian legal organization in the world. With over $100 million of revenue every year, thousands of lawyers on their payroll, and operations in hundreds of countries, they are responsible for a lot of the legal outcomes that have had massive impacts on dozens of countries. Here, at the US Supreme Court alone, the ADF's worked on and won 16 cases. Cases that resulted in things like making it legal for businesses to discriminate against gay people, protecting billionaires who donate to dark money groups from having their donations go public, and most famously, the ADF are the ones responsible for overturning Roe v. Wade. It's hard to understate just how influential they are. For decades now, the ADF's wormed its way into just about every aspect of the legal system all over the country. Not just in the courtroom, but at every step of the process. See, before anything even happens, before any case gets to the Supreme Court, the ADF partners with conservative politicians. They write bills, lobby heavily, and promise high evangelical turnout to get those bills signed into law. Bills that they wrote very strategically with the intention of creating a mismatch between different states' laws. That way, as cases get tried in different circuits, judges hand down different verdicts, and the Supreme Court is forced to intervene and settle disagreements, giving the ADF opportunities to overturn rulings at the highest level, like they did with Roe.
On a day that changed America, we're outside the Supreme Court after the landmark decision that overturned Roe versus Wade and ended a woman's constitutional right to an abortion.
Okay, that's bad, and there's more. It's not enough for the ADF to get cases in front of judges if those judges will just dismiss them out of hand. So, the ADF also runs a program in parallel to all this political stuff called the Blackstone Legal Fellowship. The fellowship trains lawyers in the ADF's ultra-conservative Christian approach, which I'll get to in a second. And then, most importantly, the fellowship becomes a funnel for lawyers trying to get a better launch into their career. It can be a catapult for young lawyers, people looking to gain some clout and power, because the ADF is shockingly well-connected. Right now, 60 Blackstone Fellowship alums have federal court clerkships. And at the very highest level, the fellowship works closely with people like Amy Coney Barrett, Mike Johnson, Mike Pence, William Barr, Jeff Sessions, and Josh Hawley. So all this means they don't just write the laws and work on the lawsuits, they've also got their people judging these cases. They have their fingerprints on every step of the process. And the thing is that, as successful as this has been in the US, we're just the tip of the iceberg. Last year, the ADF claimed they scored 66 legal victories in the US. Internationally, though, that number was almost three times higher. On their website, the ADF's international wing shows off some of these cases that they work on. And they look a lot like the kinds of things we're used to in the US. Like, right now, the big case they're advertising is their defense of Päivi Räsänen, a Finnish MP whose free speech they say is being attacked by her government. The way they tell the story, Räsänen's only crime is tweeting a screenshot of the Bible that says homosexuality is shameful. They say she's being cancelled for simply asking questions and quoting scripture. She says she's defending freedom of speech and religion from an authoritarian government. The real story is that since 2004, she's been saying homosexuality is a psychosexual disorder, that it has an inherent brokenness, that gay marriage is not just anti-Christian, but encourages homosexuality, and that therefore any normalization of queerness is a danger to children, and that queer people should be, quote, treated and converted back to straightness. In the pamphlet I'm pulling all this from, she's also regularly doing the thing anti-LGBT people do of equating homosexuality and pedophilia, saying that they're inextricably linked as a way to ban homosexuality. This is not free speech. It is quite clearly hate speech intended to justify the marginalization, if not outright extermination, of a group. The ADF, though, tucks all that away for the much more media-friendly free speech defenders narrative. They are desperate to bill themselves as people who defend freedom worldwide. But that's a lie. And it's obvious when you look at how the group started, with the goal of outlawing gay people from public existence. Since its inception, the ADF has made claims about queer people that you are familiar with already. Flat-out lies that all queer people want to sexualize children and that they're pedophiles, that they're a health risk because of the public association of queerness with HIV, and that if people are gay, it's only because they've been ensnared and indoctrinated. Obvious lies that the ADF has leveraged time and time again to try to get things like sodomy laws back on the books, keeping queer discrimination legal in housing and employment, and banning gay marriage. They don't defend freedom. They want queer existence tightly regulated and persecuted by the state. The problem is that in the early 2000s, the ADF was losing that battle, at least in the US. So the group shifted its priorities abroad, where they thought they'd have a better chance. Like, for example, in Belize. When a case went to the Supreme Court arguing that the country's anti-sodomy laws were unconstitutional, the ADF jumped to defend the pro-criminalization side. This is not very freedom-loving. So even more so than in Räsänen's case, the ADF tried to keep the details of their involvement under wraps. Same story in other places, like France, where the ADF was similarly fighting on the anti-freedom side and arguing in favor of mandated sterilization of trans people. That was in 2017. They defended sterilizing people on the grounds that, quote, "equal dignity does not mean that every sexual orientation warrants equal respect. You know, freedom for me, but not for thee." And in Germany, in another case that, as far as I can tell, they don't advertise on their website, the ADF defended a Christian fundamentalist group that had been using corporal punishment on children. The state had moved the kids to keep them safe, the parents complained that it was in their rights to beat their children, and the ADF agreed with them on the grounds that keeping families together was more important than making sure kids were safe. That this was all a question of religious freedom. There are thousands of cases like this in dozens of countries, and for all the attention I've given them here, the ADF is not alone in this work. Between 2008 and 2017, over $50 million were poured into Europe alone by a dozen similar far-right evangelical groups fighting for stricter laws that limit LGBT and women's freedoms. $280 million worldwide. The ADF doesn't like this image, though. They argue that they're not here to push their religion on the world. No, no, they're against international organizations imposing moral norms on sovereign countries. All the pro-LGBT stuff? That's the foreign influence from the woke one-world government. Except, it's not. For most of the world, the criminalization of queerness has always been a Western import, whether that's in the Middle East, Asia, or Africa. In more than half the countries where homosexuality was still criminalized in 2008, it was because those countries had inherited colonial anti-sodomy laws imposed by Western countries, usually the British. Prior to being colonized, in many of these countries, queerness as we describe it today was sometimes celebrated, sometimes seen as normal, sometimes tolerated, and sometimes frowned upon. But it's only when colonizers came that it was criminalized. Sodomy laws were spread throughout the world by colonizers. They were designed to be as vague as possible, encompassing everything from same-sex relationships and cross-dressing to violent sex crimes and pedophilia, without making any distinction between them. That way, colonizers could get away with policing whoever they felt like in the colonies as part of their project to put entire continents under their boot. And then, those laws could become a template for politics back home, allowing the state to police British couples into rigid gender roles. No gays in public, women at home, powerless, and with human relationships reduced to popping out a Christian baby once in a while. It's a strategy that's worked before, and it's a strategy they're trying to run again.
But if the premise of transgenderism is wrong, it can't just be wrong for little kids, it's got to be wrong for everyone because it's about human nature. So I guess not only are we going to eradicate transgenderism from the 11th grade girls volleyball team, that means we need to eradicate transgenderism from public life entirely, the whole preposterous ideology at every level. Well, if transgenderism is wrong, that means that there really are distinctions between men and women. If there really are distinctions between men and women and one can't become the other and those distinctions are really meaningful, then maybe we need to rethink that redefinition of marriage thing.
You're not dumb. You can see the goal isn't freedom. They want more gays in jail. The goal isn't protecting the kids. They're fine if their parents beat them. The goal is Christian supremacy, a very specific version of Christian supremacy that leaves no room in society for queer people, premarital sex, women in the workforce, or anything else that could give power to anyone other than selfish, God-fearing men. And the more it looks like the whole world is on board, the easier that gets to achieve. We can't let that happen. The more willing some on the left become to sacrifice queer people, women, whoever, the less free we all are.